Friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA. There is an exhibition it was just produced in time for the beginning of St. Patrick's Month. And at the beginning of March, out of nowhere, there is an exhibition at the Irish Consulate in New York, and it is entitled A Monumental Legacy, and the monumental Archbishop John J. Hughes and the building of St. Patrick's Cathedral. He was the dagger of his time and his era, and I'm welcome to welcome the dagger of communications and the person of Tullamore McConnell. How are you, Tullamore?
Hi, Adrian. It's great to be called the dagger of communications, but great to be with you, Adrian, as always.
Let me first of all ask you about Hughes himself. All we kind of ever knew about it is that about Hughes for a long time, Archbishop, that he in fact was very forthright in his criticisms, of the British and during the Irish famine. We know that on Irish Hunger Memorial in Battery Park City, through Maureen Murphy, indeed historian Maureen Murphy, that a lot of his writings, very pronounced, he could fit a lot into two sentences that may not fit into a paragraph of any other. He well deserved his title.
It's a strange story for me because I think, like a lot of people, I had a lot of my own, I should say, misconceptions about Hughes before I had the opportunity to work on this story, which was about a year ago when we started pulling this story together to show it in an exhibition. And I had first kind of stumbled, I had heard of Hughes, of course, as we all do, and I'd heard about Dagger Hughes, and I had my own idea what that meant and who he was. But it was when I first went to his house, the cottage that he was born in County Tyrone, which is preserved at the Ulster American Folk Park.
Yes.
And I walked into that house, and I suddenly got the sense of him as a little boy in that house, and that knowing that this little boy was going to grow up and have such a profound effect on Irish America. I would say he's the first great Irish American leader. And so that kind of piqued my interest. So, about a year later when I was approached to pull the story together, I already had beginnings of feelings for Hughes that would increase when I really began to understand his story. So I think one of the things he's called Dagger Hughes for a couple of reasons. One of them is that bishops and archbishops, before their name, they had to draw a little cross. Yeah. And his little cross, crucifix that is, looked more like a dagger than a crucifix. So it was kind of an interesting little symbol. But he was a fighter, and he was many things, but above everything else, he was a brilliant man. He was a very brilliant thinker and a very brilliant leader. And that comes across in his life story.
He came to the United States at 19?
He was 19. He just turned, he just turned 20.
Mm-hmm.
So he probably started packing his bag when he was 19, and he was on the boat by 20. And the family lived in that house that I mentioned that I visited,
yeah,
in Tyrone, and his father and mother had already gone ahead to Maryland. And there was a huge migration of people from Ulster to Northern Maryland, Southern Pennsylvania area. I don't know, maybe it's because it looks like Ulster, but they're all there. I think it a lot had to do with the great John Carroll family. He was the signatory of the Declaration of Independence, and the only Catholic, I believe, to have signed that. But the Carroll family were there, ensconced in that area, and they brought a lot of people there. So there was a very strong Ulster presence in that area. So John J. Hughes came over after his father and mother were settled in Chambersburg, and he got a job as a gardener in Emmitsburg, Pennsylvania. And that began his real journey. He was a gardener back in Toronto, by the way, but he became a gardener on the grounds of the seminary that he would enter to become a priest.
He at that point, though, when he arrived in the United States, he had very little formal education.
Absolutely. Well, remember, when he was born, like 17, he was born like in the 1790s, 97, Ireland was not too long after penal laws, so the rights for Catholics to be educated was still very new, and they were educated not in any, you know, advanced states of public schools and stuff, but he had the most basic education. He was essentially uneducated, and this, I think, was the thing that drove Hughes his whole life, was that he was furious that he was not allowed to be educated, and he was determined to see that no Catholic would be in that position. So that's he became a fighter almost immediately on the rights to education.
What brought him to New York, and in particular, what was how do you describe the area where St. Patrick's Cathedral? It wasn't exactly the hub of any place.
Well, that's true. Well, what brought him to New York was that there's another little interesting tidbit in here. When he was in Emmitsburg as a gardener, and by the way, his house, his log cabin that he lived in, mm-hmm. in Emmitsburg, still stands. And for people who go down to the seminary, it's now the College of Mount St. Mary's in Emmitsburg, they can go up the mountain and see the cottage, the log cabin. It's really a beautiful part of the country.
Thought you were going to say it's a beautiful log cabin.
It is that as well. You know, people.
Amazing that it's still standing because.
Well, yeah, it is standing, has been restored, and, mm-hmm. you know, it's, okay. and all that. But he couldn't get into the seminary as easily as he would had he had a background of education. But the mythology is that Mother Seton, who became America's first saint,
right.
she had her convent right in Emmitsburg as well, again given to her by the Carroll family. And it said that she put in a word or two to the director of the seminary, whose name was, he was a Reverend Dubois, a Frenchman. And he himself was to go on to become New York's third bishop. But he reluctantly took Hughes into that seminary, and Hughes proved himself to be very quickly a brilliant scholar, a great writer, thinker, speaker of the lot. And so Dubois hired him, and when he was ordained, Hughes was like at the forefront of the movement in Philadelphia and Baltimore, which were more active parishes than New York was even at that stage, because mm-hmm. New York was still small. But he worked for Dubois and got a reputation very quickly as a fighter for the rights of Catholics to be educated. And that came to kind of major attention. So when Dubois came into New York to be the bishop, he was in very bad health, and Hughes was his deputy. And within a very short space, Hughes was doing his job, basically, and then Hughes became the fourth bishop of New York. Of course, they were based down at St. Patrick's Old Cathedral, down at Mulberry Street here in New York. And they were there for a couple of years, and he took on full force. He took on the nativists and those that did not want the Catholics or immigrants to be educated. Some echoes of what might still go on today. Hmm. But so within a very short space, Hughes had really kind of mapped out this territory for religious freedom and education, and came to the attention of the governor of New York State, which at that time was Governor Seward, who would later become Abraham Lincoln's Secretary of State. And Seward liked Hughes and liked what Hughes was trying to achieve, because Seward, even though he was Protestant, thought that the immigrants were getting a really raw deal. And he saw in Hughes a leader emerging. So anyways, that was, so there were, this was all happening out of downtown, Old St. Pat's. So then, of course, what happened, which was that changed everything, was that the famine had occurred in Ireland, and there were hundreds of thousands of immigrants flowing into New York, and the city between 1845 and 1850s was transformed, was doubled in size, and Hughes was at the top of the leadership.
The monumental legacy is actually and it tells the story of the evolution of Irish America, centered on the East Coast.
Because New York, as was happening in New York at the time, and still happens today to this day, is that what was going on in New York was really having an influence around the country. But also, you know, the thing that's going on in our exhibition, we do two things in this exhibition. We show paintings of wonderful paintings that have been loaned by the collector Brian P. Burns from his collection of Irish art. And we show paintings of what Ireland was like at the time that Hughes left it. You know, the scenes of native life, if you will. Mm-hmm. Although there are some, there's one painting in there of Dublin Castle that was painted right at the top of the famine, 1848, and it shows you all the pomp and circumstances within Dublin Castle while outside people were dying.
And astonishing, yeah. It's astonishing because it looks like something out of Disney, you know, and it's a marvelous painting, and we did not get an opportunity to, you know, to address anything like the social life of the day. We sometimes figure that all of that stuff was happening in England, and actually wasn't right.
No, Ireland was very much the Ireland was the second great city of the British Empire at that point. Dublin was the city. But so that one painting, and then the other paintings, there were paintings by Jack Yates, by Sean Keating, Erskine Nicholls, some of the greatest painters, Irish painters, who you know, are in the exhibition here. And the reason they're here is to give a sense of the Ireland that Hughes and the others came from, and so that you can start balancing both stories. So what was, you know, and I believe that the both stories, as Brian Burns said when he loaned the paintings, he said, Irish art has for too long been in the shade, as has John J. Hughes. His reputation has been too long in the shade. He's been forgotten. But here, you know, with the famine, immigrants, with the city exploding population-wise, he realized he needed to have a bigger cathedral. He needed a bigger sanctuary for his people. So he hired James Renwick, the great architect of the day, who had built a Smithsonian a castle at the museum at Washington. And so he hired Renwick to start mapping out a cathedral, and that thus began the building of the cathedral.
He never lived, unfortunately, to see his work. He had the vision. He had not only did he have the vision, but he had the wherewithal to come up with what was a monumental amount of money in an area that, for all intents and purposes, had, you know, sheep grazing and you know, a lot
right.
of this farmland in the place. As a matter of fact, in your exhibition here, if you take a look at, it seems like the foundation and the building, incidentally, of the main doorway seems like it's sitting on a field. Nobody even bothered.
Well, it was. It was. Actually, the doorway was on a field. The side of the church was a graveyard that the Catholic, that Hughes had bought for the diocese. New York had just become a diocese at that point. And Hughes had just become the first Archbishop of New York. So he was the fourth bishop, the first archbishop. So he decided, when he decided to build the cathedral, he decided to build it 3 miles outside of New York.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a Jesuit priest tell us recently that the Jesuits owned the land, but they saw no future in it. So Hughes bought it, and he started the work there, built the cathedral, and as you say, you know, he was raising money, and we had been given wonderful access to the archives at the Archdiocese, so we could photograph many of the documents in the papers. But today, people who raise money, fundraisers, would do well to study Hughes, because he really understood the principles of how to fundraise for this cathedral. But the thing that happened was that the Civil War broke out. So once the Civil War happened right on his doorstep, all funding ceased, and he was he was stuck, and so it became called, they called the cathedral Hughes's Folly, just mm-hmm. like. And at this stage, I mentioned Governor Seward a minute ago. Alaska was Governor Seward's folly, but Seward at this point was the Secretary of State for Abraham Lincoln, and he recognized in Hughes that Hughes had another talent that they decided to use, the Lincoln administration decided to use, and that was that Hughes was a superb diplomat. So even though he had this kind of pejorative, nickname of Dagger John, mm-hmm. he was a very skilled diplomat, very smooth, knew how to talk through these issues. And so Lincoln administration, President Lincoln sent him to Europe, sent him to London, sent him to Paris and Rome, to keep those people out from joining the Confederacy or supporting the Confederacy. So that was his last big public act. But the cathedral sat there empty and kind of at a loss. And when Seward came back again, he was in his 60s, which is not old today, mm-hmm. but at mm-hmm. that point, he had every, known ailment to man, rheumatism and arthritis and all kinds of major issues. But his last civic deed was that he was called out to stop the draft riots. And from the balcony of his home, and at this stage he was living down on Madison Avenue and 35th Street across...
It's actually his sister's home.
Yeah. Yeah. He came out on the balcony of his sister's home and spoke to the crowd and just kind of helped to disperse the crowd so that they stopped. And this was the last, and then just shortly after that, he passed away. And they thought, well, we don't know what's going to happen next. It took another 15 years until the cathedral actually opened in 1879. Mm-hmm. And by that point, Bishop McCormick, who had then became America's first cardinal, was the man in charge of getting the project moving. So in 1879, to great fanfare, it opened without any pews in the cathedral. They had the great cathedral fair, which ran for about a month, and mm-hmm. they raised all kinds of money and sold all kinds of, I guess, kind of like the missions, holy pictures and all kinds of things like that, and raised a lot of money to finish the job.
And right before the opening of St. Patrick's Cathedral, one of your art pieces, and it's fantastic. It looks more like a mall affair. The kind of support there wasn't. It's the most amazing.
Basically, you had every parish in New York gather in the cathedral and set up stalls, raising money, cookies, the usual things, but all in one concentrated space. And then over time, it became the place to go. And, hopefully our whole point of doing this exhibition here at the request of Cardinal Dolan was to help show, the importance of St. Patrick's Cathedral from a historic point of view so that people would get excited and enthusiastic about restoring it, because of course it needed to happen. There were stones falling off the cathedral, and it's becoming a real dangerous spot.
Right.
But now that they're into the restoration, they've done a lot of the work. The scaffolding is coming down on the outside. The stonework has all been shown again to what it looked like back then. I mean, it's the greatest testimony possible to Irish American craftsmanship of the time. not that we're just Irish working on it, but of all of the different attributes of the cathedral is pretty astonishing. And I think we're going to see that when the work is completed over the next year or two.
Yeah, and it's and that's an ongoing struggle too, because we've had a lot of economic devastation here in this country too when that was undertaken. So.
Oh yeah, I mean, you know, you just have to rely on those people who have the resources to help do this. And fortunately, they're coming forward. People are contributing, and there's a real effort there, and there are some very generous people who are contributing to it for all kinds of reasons. I mean, the stories are quite amazing of some people who are given to help the restoration.
Now, I would like you to tell us about Brian P. Burns and his collection of Irish art.
Right. Well, Brian Burns, who I've had the pleasure, the privilege of knowing for 20 years now, Brian started to collect Irish art in the 50s. And he was the guy when there were artwork was being sold in Ireland, and it was to deal with a famine or to deal with peasant life or whatever. People said, well, who would want this? And every dealer in Ireland knew that there was only one guy who really wanted this, and that was Brian Burns. Brian was the grandson of the great grandson of famine immigrants, and he was always so inspired.
What line of work? How did he?
His father, Brian's father, was pretty. Brian is a brilliant guy. His father was very noteworthy too. His father was the first Catholic graduate from Harvard University. His father was the youngest judge in the state of Massachusetts. His father was appointed by FDR with Joe Kennedy at one point, and just to kind of work on the whole financial industry as a kind of a watchdog. John Burns, judge, he was, as I said, a judge. But he died in very early 50s, in his early 50s, and left a pretty big family, about five kids. Brian would be, the middle there somewhere. And but all the kids went to, they went to good school, good universities. The father died very young, so they were kind of, they were pretty much on their own with the help of a great mother, of course. But Brian became interested in real estate and was trained as a lawyer and became very successful. But he said, even though in the beginning he didn't have a lot of money, but whatever money he had left over, and he himself had four children, that he liked Irish art. And out of respect to his background, he started collecting Irish art. So the bottom line is now that Brian has something like 300 pieces of Irish art, both paintings and sculptures, that are some of the greatest pieces of in the world of artists who are just really top flight in Ireland.
Right.
He's shown the entire collection maybe four or five times over the last 20 years. I had the good fortune to go with him on a couple of these and help organize a couple of these exhibitions.
You talked him into it, but anyway, go ahead.
No, he's way ahead of me. He's ahead of me. In fact, he's ahead of me on this. He talked me into this. He said, let's figure out how we can do this. He wanted to use his paintings to help tell the story of Ireland.
And, of course, we have to also know that we've known him through Quinnipiac University and through John Lee.
Exactly. Well, Brian has given wonderful artwork to John Leahy, to the museum, Ireland's Great Hunger Museum in Hampden. And Brian was, right up there as soon as the museum opened to give them a gift of a wonderful Irish painting. And John, of course, would be very much like Brian, a new generation, really, in that he believes in the power of art to tell our story, to tell the history of Ireland, and to tell it effectively.
How, for the art, where was the art, and where did he manage to get it? Was it not, had it gone out of the...
Some of it he got in Ireland, some of it was, there's Irish art all over the world.
I know, but it wasn't, because of Ireland's history and the famine, and... the aftermath of the famine, was the art you know, wasn't stored in an attic somewhere.
Oh, no,
like
no,
a fold
no. Yeah.
Or...
Well, many of the artists, of course, many of the artists, particularly the earlier artists in the 1700s and late 1700s, they were painting for the people who would be patrons of the arts. And they,
right.
you know, so many of those artists. But the newer artists, and this would be the 19th century artists, people who were painting in the 1860s and 1880s and beyond that, they were painting for people who not only loved art, but also were very tied into the culture of the country. So many of the pieces that Brian came into Brian's hands, for example, well, a couple of the arts, I think there's one here in our show that belonged to John Quinn. And John Quinn was a New York lawyer who was one of the great supporters of Irish culture. He was a patron to James Joyce. The father of William Butler Yeats, who was the brother of Jack Yeats, lived here in New York as a permanent guest, shall we say, of John Quinn's.
Yeah.
John Quinn. So some of the art would have been in New York, and it found its way around the world as it continues to
right.
do. But Brian had some very good dealers in Ireland who would call him up if there was a big sale.
And we were talking about Irish art. Irish American art became, the lack of art and the scarcity of art in Ireland. A lot of that was actually a lot of those painters and their own family legacy brought them over here. Anyway,
well, yeah, there were, there's all kinds of wonderful art going that's circulating. Art has a way of kind of circulating.
Yeah.
It's got its own currency. There are families, I know of several painters who came over and lived here and lived out their lives here, and their children have their work. And their children, you know, sell their work, of course, because that's how they managed to survive. But Burns has around 300 pieces, but he's been generous in showing it. He's a big believer in showing it and letting people, experience it themselves. And that's what's great about having somebody like him, like who volunteers to let it be seen. So it's going to be at the Irish Consulate up until the end of July.
Yeah.
And it's a great opportunity. It's free. People just have to make an appointment to come in and see it, or if they're in with a group or whatever, we can arrange to have some of our volunteer guides here to walk them around.
Fantastic.
And show them things. Yeah.
And it's ironic indeed that exhibition is taking place at the Irish Consulate, because actually you look down from the consulate and there it is. It's dwarfed by the,
even the church next door to the consulate, St. Bartholomew's, which is an Episcopal church, that was built by one of Renwick's people as well. I mean, the stories just connect in wonderful ways. But I think the most powerful way of all is the life of John J. Hughes and what he managed to do.
Right.
And we have a chance, all of us now, to reevaluate and have another look at John J. Hughes.
Now, this obviously, this exhibition, which, and you are curator, you've been curator in many, many museums and works of art, both here and in Ireland. But let me just ask you about the art and the art pieces that you got from the Archdiocese, and with a lot of support, from...
They were great.
Yeah.
They were great.
But from Cardinal Dolan.
Yeah.
Where had those...
Well, that's a whole other story. The first thing that I was able to do was, thanks to the people at the Archdiocese, they brought me right up to Yonkers, where the archives of the Archdiocese are stored at Dunwoody, which is the great seminary of Rome.
Indeed, yes.
And Cardinal O'Connor had, to his credit, had built an archive, a new building, right beside the old Dunwoody Seminary before he died, because he was a very – O'Connor was a historian as well, and he recognized that they had great holdings. But nothing really, it didn't really move into that new building. It was still in the old seminary The seminary, pretty amazing.
Now, was it displayed in the seminary, or was it a holding?
No, it was for research. Yeah. It was primarily for research. And, you know, truth be told, not a lot of people were getting, admitted to it. There was a lot of complications with that. But Cardinal Dolan is also a historian.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the great pleasures I had was to hear Dolan and Burns having a conversation. I mean, these men knew so many people in common. Burns was baptized by Cushing alone, Cardinal Cushing. So, I mean, there's tremendous history in their conversation. But Cardinal Dolan has pretty much, energized the archives at the Archdiocese, and now they have terrific people in charge of the archives there. And for us, which was wonderful, is they went into the archives and helped us select pieces. And then I brought them all out and had them photographed by one of our great photographers.
Yes.
And so hopefully we'll get lots of this online and be able to share it with people.
Considering that the consulate, and indeed the building that houses Ireland House, that was never meant to it wasn't built as accommodating an art gallery. And yet, when you walk through this, it's incredible. And we are friends. We are at the Irish Consulate, and Charlotte McConnell, curator, he walked me around the place. And you have it segmented actually to take us, take anybody from 1500s.
They can read. People can read. We lay it out pretty much like a magazine.
Mm.
So it's an easy thing to read, but at the same time, you can spend a lot of time examining and thinking about these pieces. But it needs to be, exhibitions. That's why I like exhibitions. They're meant for people like me who like to get a very quick look at a subject. And then if I want to go deeper, I have the opportunity to do that on my own time.
Mm-hmm.
But how can we, we've been so blessed. We've got these beautiful paintings that are world class. We had people on opening night here. We had people here from the Metropolitan Museum of Art. We had people from the New York Historical Society. We had people who know that this is the real deal. And, of course, my thanks is to our Consul General, Noel Kilkenny.
Who is fantastic. You've had another exhibition.
Well,
here.
The other big exhibition we had here about 4 years ago was thanks to the previous Consul General, Niall Burgess.
Yes.
And Niall Burgess allowed us to put up an exhibition in here for the Great Hunger. And out of that exhibition, John Leahy, who owned the collection for Quinnipiac University, it inspired John to go ahead with a vision he had to build a museum dedicated to the Great Hunger, which is up in Hamden, Connecticut.
Yes.
And it's in its second year, and doing phenomenally well. People love that museum.
Know, yes. Absolutely. Yeah.
So my hope is that out of this Hughes exhibition, that Hughes will get in New York, in the right venue, he will get his museum. He deserves it. And the people who built St. Patrick's Cathedral deserve their museum.
After all, it is, and it's known as America's Irish Parish.
There you go.
Again, friends, let me just let you know that we are talking about an exhibition, including 8 works from the Brian Burns collection of Irish art, celebrating indeed the restoration of St. Patrick's Cathedral here. It is taking place at the Consulate General of Ireland in New York, which is at 51st Street and Park Avenue. It continues until July 31st. You can not only get information, but best thing to do is to get in touch directly let me give you the opening times and days. Weekdays it's from 11 to 4. Now it is by appointment, only, but that's not to say that you will not be very welcome. Call And for security and for as anybody who would visit Midtown Manhattan, you are going to just have to get a clearance. It's not a big deal, but also the other thing that I might suggest is that you call Turla McConnell, who is the curator, and his telephone number is 2122. I was going to say this is obviously not yours because this is the consulist number. I would know that. 213-219-2555. And then how?
Extension 0. And they'll give you the information. You just leave a message, and if no one's there, leave a message, and they will be right back to you and set up an appointment.
And you can actually get onto your own website. It's info at turlochmcconnell.com.
TurlochMcConnell.com. Or you can go on St. Patrick's Cathedral website /Hughes,
yes,
and you'll get all the information.
Very good.
All right, Adrian. Thank
you. Now, can
so
you
much.
Spell your name, Tara McConnell? Can you spell that backward? Oscalga.
There are so many pronunciations of spelling
my name. All right.
Or Adrian, of course, they can always go to your info at irishradio.com.
Very good. That's what we needed. One more. We're very proud of it, and in fact, it is well worth seeing, and to all involved, and in particular, we've been friends for a long time, but this one is very, very special.
Thank you, Adrian. You're a great friend.
And friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network USA. If you